Welcome back to Introduction to International Relations. This lecture, which is our last, is about insurgency. As always, the goals for this lecture appear on slide number one. First, I'm going to provide a definition of insurgency. There are others out there, as with terrorism, but the one I'll provide is sufficient for our purposes and doesn't contradict any others. Second, we'll discuss a number of studies that help us understand who participates in violence and why they do so. I'll begin this section by offering evidence that identity is at least partially malleable, as constructivists have long argued. Then I'll try to convince you that identity-based factors don't account for participation in civil war nearly as well as most people think, anyway. Then I'll introduce a model that looks a bit like ones you've seen in recent lectures, but is also a little more complicated, as it simultaneously accounts for bargaining between the government and a group of extremists, as well as bargaining between the extremists and the general population. A number of interesting implications come from this model, but the one I'd like to emphasize most is that anything that encourages the average person to participate in violence should, all else equal, reduce the likelihood of violence in the first place. That may sound obvious, stated this way, but you'll realize later on that this simple claim is at odds with some popular notions about how to prevent conflict. Okay, turn to the second slide, where you'll find the definition we'll be using. For our purposes, an insurgency is a period in which one or more groups seeks to undermine established authority through irregular warfare. Simply put, insurgencies are civil wars, but we must be careful not to use the terms as synonyms because insurgency is not the only type of civil war. It's the most common one, particularly in recent years, and the other types do not occur for the same reasons or have the same dynamics, which is why I thought it worth dedicating an entire lecture to insurgency. But you should still be aware that wars occurring solely within the boundaries of one state need not take the form of insurgency specifically. Two other types of civil war are conventional and communal. A conventional civil war pits one regular army against another, though only one of them would represent the current government. What do I mean by a regular army? Well, that just means that there's a clear command structure and the soldiers wear uniforms and carry their weapons openly. When I spoke of irregular warfare a moment ago, I referred to cases where one side does not have a clear command structure, wear uniforms, and carry weapons openly. Put differently, subterfuge, sabotage, ambush, and other guerrilla tactics, as well as terrorism in many cases, are the insurgents' stock in trade. In conventional civil wars, the two sides meet openly on the battlefield and clash head to head without anyone running and hiding from the other. These have become less common over time because modern states typically have an enormous material advantage over would-be rebels, and meeting them openly on the battlefield would be suicide. But there are examples of this historically, such as the U.S. Civil War and the English Civil War. At the other end of the spectrum, communal civil wars pit one irregular army against another, neither of which represents the government. For example, we often speak of the war in Syria that began in 2011, but it would be more accurate to speak of several different wars taking place in the same country at the same time. Some of those wars involve government forces and qualify as insurgencies. Others do not and should be seen as communal. In other words, this lecture is meant to help you understand why ordinary people take up arms against their government, and how governments interact with extremists when they expect them to secure the support of broad swaths of the population. it is not meant to explain conventional civil wars, which I think are pretty well accounted for by the arguments developed to explain interstate wars, despite the nominal difference between the two, or communal wars, which are a bit more complicated and beyond the scope of this module. With that said, let's talk about the role of identity. On the third slide, I identify three reasons to doubt that there is a simple, straightforward connection between identity-based cleavages and the likelihood of conflict, as so many people assume there to be. When I speak of identity-based cleavages, incidentally, I'm using academic jargon for the popular notion that wars occur because of intolerance, that a country divided along ethno-linguistic or religious lines is more likely to experience conflict because people just don't know how to get along with one another, especially those who are different. Ethno-linguistic, by the way, is a fancy term for having to do with either language or ethnicity. As for cleavage, which I'm sure some of you sniggered at, being oh so mature, that just means line of separation. Yes, there are other lines of separation that people sometimes think about. The first reason to doubt the claim that war is the inevitable result of a divided society is that there have been many attempts to establish a pattern of association along these lines, and they haven't been particularly successful. Various critiques have been made of the influential studies that claim there is no relationship, and some of those critiques are pretty sophisticated, but the best we can say at this time is that the evidence is mixed. There's a case to be made that more divided societies are more prone to conflict, but it's nowhere near as strong as you might think. The simplest way to think about this is, for every country you can name with an ongoing conflict that's clearly about religious or ethnic differences, there's a country that's deeply divided along similar lines that's at peace, or more likely, several such countries. Sure, you've got your Syrias and your Iraqs, but let's not forget about Belgium and Canada. In fact, there are very few countries with truly homogeneous populations. The fact that civil war is as rare as it is, and while it's a lot more common in this moment in history than any of us would like, it is still rare, tells us that the story can't be as simple as, if you ask two or more groups to live side by side, they'll inevitably come into conflict with one another. I realize no one thinks it's that simple, but honestly, a lot of journalistic accounts come pretty dang close, as do some of the things students have said in their essays in the past. Something very close to what I just said appears to be the conventional wisdom. As is so often the case, though, the conventional wisdom here isn't so wise. Another reason why you should doubt that there is a straight line connecting religious and ethnic differences to the likelihood of conflict, even if you add caveats about such differences merely increasing the likelihood rather than making it inevitable, is that these arguments potentially reverse the causal arrow. That is, even if future research brings about a clear consensus that there is a pattern of association between identity-based cleavages and the likelihood of conflict, we'll still need to ask whether religious and ethnic differences cause people to fight, or whether fighting changes how people see themselves, and more importantly, describe themselves in surveys. As we'll discuss soon, there is pretty strong evidence that identities harden after armed conflicts, by which I mean that people who fit into multiple categories start finding one of them more salient. I'm not going to claim that people learn new languages as a result of armed conflicts, nor that they change their religious beliefs or anything like that. I am going to argue that the way people see themselves and the attitudes they have towards those who are different than them depends on the political context in which they find themselves. That's what I meant earlier when I said that identity is somewhat malleable. I'm not going to wake up tomorrow and decide that I'm an elderly Asian woman, no matter what happens politically between now and then. But the fact that my great-grandfather was born in Sicily meant something different to me in my youth than it does now. The same can be said for the Catholic faith I was raised in. Whether the area I grew up in counts as upstate New York or not, whiteness, and how important it is to be manly in the traditional sense. Whether an Iraqi sees him or herself as an Iraqi, as opposed to an Arab, or a Sunni, or a Shia, is not independent of the state of affairs in Iraq. When sectarian conflict reached fever pitch in the years following Saddam Hussein's ouster, there was much hand-wringing about how the Bush administration should have expected the inevitable. The thing is, though, violence between Sunni and Shia wasn't inevitable. Sectarian conflict was actually quite rare until the bombing of the Samar Mosque in 2006, several years after Saddam Hussein's regime was overthrown. Rates of intermarriage between Sunni and Shia used to be quite high. When asked how they saw themselves, both groups were likely to respond Arab. That's not to suggest there was some idyllic period of multiculturalism and tolerance in Iraq. The Sunni and the Shia were united, more than anything else, by their mutual hatred of both Jews and Kurds. The point, though, is that their religious differences didn't really mean much to them until patterns of violence started to make those differences more salient. To say that such violence was caused by religious differences that no one seemed particularly bothered by for a very long time isn't very satisfying. Similar arguments can be made about the breakup of Yugoslavia. Some people argue that the fall of the Soviet Union made conflict inevitable because there were too many peoples with too little in common being forced to live together. But there's pretty clear evidence that some of the differences people claim made those conflicts inevitable weren't very salient to anyone until Slobodan Milosevic, once a devoted communist with little interest in Serbian nationalism, decided that the quickest path to power was to fan the flames of tribalism. The third reason to be skeptical of the claim that religious and ethnic differences make conflict more likely is that this assumes away a rather large collaboration problem. One of the big lessons I hope you take away from this module is that large groups of people rarely come together to work towards a common cause. I know that's a hard claim to wrap your head around, in part because it doesn't seem like it should be true, but we've talked a few times now about how cooperation doesn't always occur even when everyone agrees that it would be beneficial, and this is just another example of it. The world's governments have been very slow to work together in combating climate change. You all were, for the most part, unwilling to donate points to the class in an activity, and people generally do not risk life and limb to avenge wrongs done to those they've never met, just because those people spoke the same language or practiced the same religion. I don't expect you to just take my word for that. You've been conditioned to see the world that way for too long by too many people in positions of authority to just let go of the idea right away. That's why I'm going to describe a number of studies, only a fraction of the ones that have come to the same conclusion, demonstrating A, that identity is partially malleable, and B, that something pretty close to self-interest, ugly and unromantic as that is, does a much better job of explaining why people take up arms in the midst of a civil war and which side they fight for than whether they're sympathetic to the rebels' cause, be that for ethnic reasons or otherwise. Let's start with the claim that identity-based cleavages only matter in the right political context. Here, I mean right in the sense that certain conditions make animosity between groups more likely. I don't mean to imply that this is an outcome you or I would wish to promote. The first study we're going to discuss doesn't deal with armed conflict at all, but presents very strong evidence that animosity depends on political context. The author went to 4 villages in Africa, 2 in Malawi and 2 in Zambia, and interviewed members of 2 ethnic groups that exist on either side of the border. If you turn to the 5th slide, you'll find a map showing you where the 2 groups, the Chuas and the Tumbuakas, live and where the villages he visited are. As you can see, the 2 Chua villages are very close to each other, and the same goes for the 2 Tumbuaka villages. That's really important because it ensures that there's very little difference between the villages other than which side of the border they happen to be on. And since that border, like so many in Africa, is pretty arbitrary, being a legacy of European colonization more than a reflection of national identity, we can be pretty confident that if Chuas living in Malawi view Tumbuakas living in Malawi differently than Chuas living in Zambia view Tumbuakas living in Zambia, it's because the former live in Malawi and the latter in Zambia. Why should that matter? Well, as you can see on that same slide, Malawi is a pretty small country. As it happens, Chuas make up the largest share of the population. They don't constitute a majority, more like a third, but they're in a stronger position than any other group. In Zambia, however, they're a small minority, comprising less than 5% of the overall population. So in Zambia, unlike Malawi, Chuas haven't got a shot at influencing policy or winning office unless they cooperate with other groups. The dominant cleavage in Zambia is east-west, and both the Chuas and the Tumbuakas live in the east. In Zambia, then, they're allies, because they have to be. In Malawi, they're not, because the vote is fractured enough that appealing narrowly to a single group, even one that only makes up a third of the population, is a viable strategy for winning office. Chua politicians in Malawi talk pretty negatively about Tumbuakas, and vice versa. So if we thought identities were immutable, and tensions between groups were inevitable and irreconcilable, and born of historical grievances built up over centuries and all of that other rubbish, we'd think that their attitudes towards one another would be similar in these villages. Obviously, I wouldn't be talking about this study if I wasn't about to show you evidence to the contrary, however. Turn to the next slide. Here, you see a graph that shows the proportion of respondents in each country agreeing with a number of statements that all speak to the level of animosity between the groups in various ways. I won't go through each result in detail. You can stop this recording and study the graphs closely yourself if you wish. But it's pretty obvious, just from a cursory glance, that we're seeing some pretty stark differences. It wouldn't be fair to say that the Chuas and Tumbuakas are besties in Zambia, or that they absolutely despise each other in Malawi. But the extent to which we'd say there's tension between the groups definitely depends on whether we're talking about a country where political circumstances create powerful incentives for politicians to set aside their differences, or one where politicians can afford to alienate voters from the other group a bit more comfortably. That doesn't just affect who people vote for, either. This filters all the way down to who people are willing to marry. Again, I'm not saying that ethnicity is made up and only exists inside our heads, though some scholars come pretty close to saying that. Just that the messages people hear from political elites play a powerful role in determining their behavior. Let's move on to the next study, which paints a similar picture on a slightly different canvas. Here, we're looking at how survey respondents in 16 different countries answered a question about how they see themselves. The options included all the ethnic groups in their country, as well as their country's nationality. What we're interested in is who sees themselves first and foremost as members of their ethnic group, and who identifies primarily on the basis of nationality. Specifically, we're looking to see if there's a relationship between how people self-identify and whether the country in question recently experienced armed conflict or the threat of armed conflict. The expectation is that when there's a threat from abroad, you set aside your differences and rally around the flag. So we should see a negative pattern of association between the variable that represents whether respondents live in a country that was recently the target of a militarized interstate dispute, or MID, and the dependent variable, which represents whether the respondent self-identified on the basis of ethnicity. We're also expecting to see a positive pattern of association between that same dependent variable and the one that indicates whether the country the respondent lives in recently experienced a civil war. And as you can see on the next slide, that's exactly what we find. Interstate disputes suppress ethnic identity by promoting nationalism, while civil wars undermine a shared sense of national identity, shockingly enough, and harden ethnic identity. In other words, yes, there are lots of conflicts that pit members of one religious sect or ethno-linguistic group against those of another, and the media often describes these as sectarian or ethnic conflicts. But that doesn't mean that the reason they're fighting is because of irreconcilable differences. In many cases, it's almost the exact opposite. Their differences wouldn't seem terribly relevant to most of them if not for the conflict that was allegedly caused by those differences. Now let's talk about how ethnicity influences behavior during civil war. Or rather, let's talk about what does influence behavior during civil war, since you already know that I'm going to tell you that ethnicity isn't as important as you think. The next study looks at the Greek Civil War, which was fought in two phases. The second, and more well-known, took place after World War II. But the first overlapped with it, taking place during the Nazi occupation. The primary cleavage was ideological. It was a communist insurgency, and that was a big deal during the second phase because of the Cold War. But what we're going to focus on is how many Greeks acted against their common interest to support the Nazis, and that was acting against the ideals most espoused. There was no real fascist movement in Greece, nor did the Nazis make any attempt to foster one. They saw the Greeks as racially inferior and made that quite clear to them. So collaboration with the Nazis can't really be attributed to belief in the Aryan project. Any Greeks who were willing to kill Greeks on behalf of Nazis, using weapons provided by Germany, had to be doing so for a different reason. Yet, many of them were willing to do so. There was considerable variation from village to village, however, and that's going to help us sort out why some Greeks were willing to collaborate with the Nazis whilst others weren't. The dependent variable for this study is the number of people who did so in each of 63 villages and towns in the two main counties of one prefecture. That's just a narrow slice of one phase of one country's civil war, admittedly. But it's hard to get data about stuff like this, and the overall picture that emerges is pretty consistent with what we've seen in countless other conflicts, so don't get hung up on that. What we're looking at, again, is the number of collaborators in each village. We're looking to see if there's any relationship between that and the level of pre-war support for the incumbent regime, as there would be if we thought that what drives wartime decision-making was belief in the cause, the number of civilians killed in that town by the communist insurgents, which would give people a very personal and petty reason to help the Nazis, and the strength of the communist insurgents in that village relative to the Nazis, which should reduce the number of Nazi collaborators for pretty obvious and obviously self-interested reasons. In other words, we're looking to see whether who has the guns and what they've done to those you love matters more than who calls you a dog or whether you're passionate about empowering the proletariat. If you turn to the next slide, you'll see that our best guess about the pattern of association between pre-war support for the regime and collaboration with the Nazis is that there's a negative relationship, indicating that villages where the regime the Nazis were trying to prop up was popular, the Nazis got less help. But that pattern is not statistically significant. In other words, it doesn't really seem to matter one way or the other whether the village in question was particularly pro or anti-communist. What matters is whether the insurgents killed a lot of people in that village, in which case the survivors were willing to take up arms on behalf of a brutal racist regime that told them they were subhuman, and whether the insurgents had more soldiers in the area. In short, when people are dying all around you, your willingness to take up arms has less to do with your loyalty to your people or to some ideology, and more to do with who's responsible for the death of your loved ones, friends, and neighbors, and who it would be a really bad idea to cross. Or, to put it simply, self-interest, at least broadly construed. To be clear, we're not talking the narrowest interpretation of self-interest. Risking your life to avenge the death of a loved one or neighbor is, in some sense, selfless. I'm not saying that people don't care about anything larger than themselves at all. What I'm saying is that most people don't care all that much, regardless of what they say, about anyone or anything that isn't connected to them pretty directly. There's a mountain of evidence that religious and ethnic identity plays a powerful role in explaining why people vote the way they do, or what answers they provide in surveys, but no one's risking their life to do those things. When it comes to bloodshed, the average person's attachment to abstractions gets pretty bloody weak. My point is that most people downplay the importance of self-interest when it comes to political violence, neglecting the clear incentive to free ride. They make it sound like groups make decisions collectively rather than consisting of individuals who make decisions for themselves. It might seem reasonable to expect that if a large number of people agree that their government or some foreign occupier is horrible, they'll all work together to overthrow or force into retreat that government or occupier. That's just not how the world works, though. Sure, sometimes people work together towards a common cause, but we can't simply assume that this is the most likely outcome, because it really isn't. Across time and space, the most common experience is for people to live under a government they do not like, yet which they take no action to oppose. Let's talk about one more study that really drives that point home. This one surveyed 1,000 people in Sierra Leone a few years after that country experienced a long and brutal civil war. The dependent variable here is whether the respondent participated in the war, and if so, on which side, and whether they did so voluntarily, as most of them did, but many did not. The independent variables are various measures of selective incentives. That's a fancy term for anything that gives someone a reason to participate in collective action or not by directly rewarding or punishing participation, irrespective of whether the group succeeds. That's very different than appealing to the benefits of success. When you try to get people to volunteer or donate money or join a mailing list or whatever, by telling them that it's really, really important to achieve the goal, you are not offering a selective incentive. What you're really doing is convincing them that they should hope other people give up their time or open their wallets or expose their inboxes to spam. That's, sadly, how most activists try to achieve their objectives, but it's not very effective. When you give people a small gift for volunteering or donating money or whatever, you're giving them a reason to help out themselves rather than simply hoping that others will do so. And that works quite well, sometimes even when the reward isn't very big. So, coming back to Sierra Leone, we're looking to see whether people were more likely to participate in violence as a result of whether they were given a very personal reason to do so. The authors also included various indicators of pre-war grievances with the status quo. If collaboration problems are a big deal, as I've been trying to convince you that they are, selective incentives should do a lot to explain who participates in violence, while the indicators of grievances should not. That is, it shouldn't matter who has a very good reason to hate the government and who doesn't, but it should matter who was offered money or threatened with violence if they didn't join up or something along those lines. Again, my claim is that people don't decide whether to fight and die based on who they want to win, so much as who's waving a gun in their face at that exact moment. What makes the Sierra Leone Civil War so useful for sorting this out is that it, too, had two phases. Actually, it had more than that, but we're going to focus on two of them. First, the Revolutionary United Front, or RUF, sought to overthrow the government. Then, after they succeeded, the original government formed its own grassroots insurgency known as the Civil Defense Forces, or CDF. There were many other parties involved, and it's important to acknowledge that the conflict is a lot more complicated than I'm making it out to be. But for our purposes, it's sufficient to focus on who fought for the RUF, which, remember, wanted to overthrow the government that had been in power at the time, and who fought for the CDF, which was an insurgency aiming to restore the original government. If people tend to choose who to fight for based on whether they believe in the cause rather than something closer to self-interest, then we'd expect the poor and marginalized to support the RUF, and we'll see in a moment that they did, but not the CDF, which they also did. We'd see that most people joined the RUF voluntarily, not true, and that the only people who joined the CDF were those who had done relatively well under the original government and so might benefit from its restoration. We wouldn't expect it to matter too much whether people feared punishment for refusing to join up, or whether they were offered money to fight, how crude, or whether they felt that they, on a personal level, would be safer with a gun in their hands. But all of those things mattered, and they mattered a great deal. Far more so than whether people had reason to want the government to hold on to or later retake power. Because again, people don't fight and die for abstractions. They vote on that basis, sure. No one's saying religion, ethnicity, class, or ideology isn't important, or that they don't have a huge impact on ordinary politics. Only that most people aren't willing to risk their lives for such things, and so we need to look elsewhere to understand political violence. The next couple of slides illustrate that. First, on slide 12, you see some partial results to the open-ended question of why those who participated in the war fought on the side they fought on. Respondents were allowed to give as many answers as they wished. So note that even though I'm only listing some of them, they sum to more than 100%. The important thing here is that most of those who fought for the RUF were abducted, and very few said that they fought for the RUF because they supported the goals. Many of those who weren't abducted still said that they feared what would happen to them if they didn't join. For the CDF, a large number claimed that they fought because they supported the group's goals, but note that a fair number simply wanted to protect their community, and more than half feared punishment. Yes, we're again looking at just one conflict, because there are no studies that look at all relevant countries at once in the same fine-grained manner. This is hardly the only study, or the only conflict, that challenges the notion that rebellions are fueled by anti-government sentiment or ethnic solidarity, however. When I taught in the United States, I used to tell my students that we have ample evidence that the American Revolution wasn't that popular. Those who supported it mostly did so for economic reasons. Over time, Americans have convinced themselves that it was about death to tyranny, freedom and democracy, and lots of other romantic claptrap. But it was really about trade and taxes, and those who were already pretty wealthy wanting to be wealthier still. That's not to say I wish they hadn't or anything, but I'm very thankful that you lot eventually forgave us for rebelling after you burned down our nation's capital in the War of 1812. Similar arguments can be made about most revolutions, rebellions, and insurgencies. The leadership generally adopts pretty language, appealing to lofty notions, but when you start digging, you find that their motives weren't so pure, nor were those of their supporters. That doesn't mean they were unjustified, or that anyone everywhere has an obligation to remain loyal to their government, just that anyone who believes political violence can be explained by popular grievances, group attachments, or whatever, needs to confront all the evidence to the contrary. On slide 13, we see the results of a statistical analysis of participation in Sierra Leone Civil War. We're no longer asking people why they fought, but trying to establish patterns of association between things we know about them and whether they took up arms. And admittedly, there's a lot going on here, but the overall story being told by the results is actually pretty straightforward. First, note that people who live in houses with mud walls, those who aren't exactly living the good life, were more likely to volunteer for the RUF. That makes sense according to the "you can only push people so far before they stand up for themselves" theory of civil war. But they were also more likely to have been abducted by the RUF and more likely to volunteer for the CDF. Neither of those things fits the romantic narrative. Rather, they seem to suggest that poor people are more easily exploited by those wishing to achieve their objectives by getting others to fight for them. In other words, poor people are more likely to participate in violence because it's easier to bribe or coerce them, not because they are more likely to support the cause of the rebels. Much the same is true of those who have no access to education or are politically marginalized. Ethnic minorities, it seems, were more likely to get abducted, but there's no clear evidence that they were more likely to volunteer for either side. The patterns are not statistically significant. Those who said that they'd have felt safer inside the group, having a gun in their hands, in other words, were both more likely to join the RUF and to join the CDF. Put differently, once violence breaks out, making sure that you don't become the next victim is its own explanation for why violence continues to occur. We see a relatively similar pattern for having friends in the group, though curiously, the effect of that variable on joining the CDF is not statistically significant. Summing up, the last two studies indicate that participation in civil war doesn't seem to be driven by big picture stuff, like which side shares your ethnicity or whether the government has oppressed and impoverished you. Rather, it seems to be driven by threatened or actual harm to you or your loved ones, bribes, and other things that affect people on a pretty personal level. That's why, as we move forward now to discuss a theoretical model that I think sheds some light on patterns of political violence, we're going to assume that the willingness of the public to support the extremists, to take up arms on their behalf, is entirely dependent on what the extremists offer them, not whether they like the government or speak the same language as the extremists. Turn to the next slide. The game begins with the government offering some level of concessions to the extremists. Note that in the past, X represented what the player who chooses its size would get if the game ends peacefully. Here, it's the opposite, how much they're giving away rather than how much they're taking. Whether we set it up one way or the other doesn't actually make any difference in terms of the substantive conclusions, however. I just think it makes more sense to talk about demands that challengers make of defenders in international crises and concessions offered by governments when talking about domestic ones. This also made the algebra a tiny bit easier, though not by much. If E accepts G's offer of concessions, the game ends peacefully and the public doesn't get involved. They just keep going about their business. If E rejects, however, they resort to violence. That might be targeted against the government, or it might target civilians. More likely than not, it will be some mix of the two. We could be talking about a limited insurgency, a terror campaign, or some combination thereof, in other words. Then, at some point, E offers Y to the general public. That's a share of the spoils, in other words, or what they expect to eventually win from the government. It's not important that we think in precisely those terms, incidentally, only that E has to convince P to take up arms through selective incentives, represented here by the carrot, though it could just as easily have been the stick, which we'll soon see they're not always willing to do. Let's make sure there's no confusion about the notation so far. G is the government, E is the extremists, P is the public, X is what the government offers E to prevent violence, and Y is what E offers P once violence is underway in order to get them to take part. As you can guess, W is what E expects to get from the government after fighting, and the C terms represent the loss of utility associated with the cost of war. I'll come back to Q and Kappa in just a little bit. Note that there are two different W terms. As ever, the one with the line over it is bigger than the one with the line under it. The smaller one is what E can expect to get from G if they fight alone without help from P, while the larger one is what E can expect to get from G if P participates in violence. Okay, back to the sequence of moves. If P rejects E's choice of Y, then participation in violence remains limited. If P accepts Y, then participation will be popular. The government's payoffs are really straightforward. They start the game being pretty happy with the state of affairs and not wanting anything to change in terms of their relationship with the extremists. They have to, though, at least to some degree, because our extremists, being extremists, will not accept the status quo. That doesn't mean they're guaranteed to resort to violence. They're not. But they need to be bought off if peace is to prevail. So the government either gives them X willingly or is forced to give them W as a result of fighting, where W might either be large or small, depending on whether E gets help from P. If fighting occurs, G also feels as though they lost CG. For the sake of simplicity, there's only one CG. We could have large and small versions of that too, which would probably be realistic, but the substantive results wouldn't really change much, so let's keep it simple. For E, it's a little more complicated, but not much. If they accept G's concessions, their payoff simply reflects the size of those concessions, X. If they reject them, then their payoff depends on what they take from the government, W, how much of that they keep for themselves, everything if P doesn't participate in violence, 1 minus Y of it when P does, and the subjective cost of fighting, CE. As for P, they simply get their value for the status quo, that's what Q stands for, if G and E work things out peacefully. If E resorts to violence, but P doesn't take part, then P gets Q again, but we now subtract kappa, which represents all the downsides to living in a country that's experiencing violence. That could be because E is targeting civilians as part of their strategy, because innocent people sometimes get killed even when neither side intentionally targets them, or simply because the government is likely to increase taxes, restrict civil liberties, and so forth. Finally, if P accepts Y and participates in violence, their payoff takes a different cost into account, the cost of being directly involved in a war, rather than simply living in a country where violence takes place, which is represented by CP. They also get the share of the spoils that E offered them, Y times W over Y. Note that we could throw Q in here too, but then it wouldn't end up influencing anything. Besides, one could argue that the status quo mostly survives during periods of limited conflict, though there are some costs, and that's why kappa's there. Whereas it's likely to be disrupted pretty significantly if a full-blown war breaks out. One last detail before we move on to the results. G is assumed to be uncertain about the exact loss of utility the extremists would suffer if they engage in violence. That is, they know that CE is equal to CE overline with probability phi, and CE underline with probability 1 minus phi. We could differentiate the red and blue types by how good they are at fighting, of course, as we did in the lecture on information problems. The substantive results I'm going to emphasize, however, wouldn't differ if we did that, and this makes the solution a tad bit easier, and prevents us from needing four different versions of W, which could get hard to keep track of. Note that without an information problem, or a more complicated model that would allow us to talk about commitment problems, which might require four stages of bargaining, we wouldn't expect any type of violence to occur in equilibrium. In other words, everything I said about conflict in lectures R13 through R15 still applies, even though we're talking about insurgency and civil war now, instead of conventional wars fought between sovereign states. That is, we can't explain civil wars simply by saying that the government was terrible, so of course everyone tried to get rid of it, for the same reason that we can't explain interstate wars by simply noting that the two sides disagreed about the location of a border or some policy one side was pursuing, to say nothing of everything I said earlier in this lecture about the reasons people take up arms. Our explanation for civil war is basically the same as our explanation for interstate war, in other words. But this model is going to generate some additional insight about the overall likelihood of violence in different countries, and what form that violence will take if it does occur. As I said near the start of the lecture, we're about to see that violence is less likely to occur when the government thinks that it would see popular participation than when it would be more limited. While that might sound obvious to some people, it suggests that some popular ideas about how to prevent violence might be deeply misguided. Specifically, the model tells us that when the general public is pretty happy with the status quo, which we might expect has a lot to do with the state of the economy, the extremists are unlikely to purchase their support, and that makes the government more willing to risk rejection with their offer of concessions. This implies that alleviating poverty may well ensure that if and when violence breaks out, it will take the form of a limited insurgency or terror campaign rather than a full-blown civil war, but it might actually increase the overall likelihood of violence. That doesn't mean that poverty alleviation doesn't save lives, to say nothing of the intrinsic benefit of helping people meet their material needs, but there are people out there, including the UN and many of the world's governments, claiming that the key to preventing violence in all its forms is alleviating poverty. That isn't necessarily true, either according to this theoretical model or several recent studies that took a closer look at the statistical evidence. Let's go through the analysis so you'll have a better sense of where that conclusion comes from. As it says on the slide, P joins the conflict if and only if Y, the share of the spoils offered to them by E, is large enough. How large is large enough? That's what Y hat represents. There's a lot of moving parts in that expression, and we don't need to talk about all of them. But let's talk about some of what influences it. First, note that as kappa goes up, Y hat goes down. That means that when sitting on the sidelines while G and E battle it out is really costly, either because one of them are targeting civilians or for some other reason, then E doesn't have to promise P as much in order to get them to fight. That matches what we saw in the study of Sierra Leone, where people were more likely to take up arms if they felt safer inside the group, implying that they were worried about being a victim of violence even if they didn't take part. Note that CP has the opposite effect. That may sound like I'm saying costs are bad except when they're not, but actually tells us that E has to try harder to get P to participate when the risks of opposing the government are greater because the insurgents are taking heavy casualties. In principle, P support can always be bought. However, E isn't always going to pay the price. Sometimes they literally can't. That would be true when Y hat takes on values greater than 1, which it might. Other times they can, but they won't. While the model takes for granted that E will win more from G with P support than without, they don't get to keep everything they win from G when P takes part. Sometimes, keeping 100% of a smaller slice of pie is better than getting a larger slice but having to share with someone else. We can determine whether E is willing to secure P's support by comparing Q to Q hat. Specifically, if Q is less than or equal to Q hat, then E will set Y equal to Y hat. That means that when the general populace is relatively dissatisfied with the status quo, the extremists are going to secure their support by bribing them. When the general populace is relatively happy with the status quo, however, The extremists either can't or won't do so. Since Q hat is even messier than Y hat, we're not going to spend a lot of time interpreting that either. But you'll note that kappa and CP have the effects you'd expect given what we said about them earlier. That is, larger values of kappa make it more likely that E will secure P support by raising Q hat and thereby ensuring that any given value of Q is more likely to lie beneath it, whereas the opposite is true of CP. Okay, on to the next slide. The front end of the model is very similar to what we saw in the lecture on information problems, though it's slightly more involved. E accepts G's offer if and only if they get at least as much of what they want by doing so as they would from fighting. That gives us four critical values of X, though. The level of concessions required by the blue type when they know they won't secure the support of P, the level required by the red type under the same conditions, and the levels required by the blue and red types when E knows that they would secure the support of P, as determined by Q and Q hat. As for the government, they sometimes risk violence by offering terms that only the blue type would accept, and sometimes play it safe by offering terms that both the blue and red types would accept. Nothing new there. What's different is that they compare phi to a different phi hat here than the challenger did in the model in lecture R15. We also need two different phi hats, one for when the government risks having to deal with a limited insurgency or terror campaign, because Q is greater than Q hat and thus E won't buy P's support, and one where they risk facing a popular insurgency and thus a full-blown civil war, because Q is less than or equal to Q hat and thus E will buy P's support. The important thing to note here is that one of these phi hats is strictly smaller than the other. How do I know that? Because the one has all the same terms as the other, plus a few other ones. Anytime you add something to both the top and bottom of a fraction, you make it bigger, as we've discussed before. Why does that matter? Well, when phi is less than both of them, we're not going to see violence either way. When phi is greater than both of them, the probability of violence is 1 minus phi, regardless of whether that violence would see limited participation or not. When phi is in the middle, however, peace is certain when violence would see popular participation, but occurs with probability 1 minus phi if it would not. In other words, violence is more likely to occur, all else equal, when Q is relatively large, because Q plays a critical role in determining whether violence will see popular participation. The final slide makes that clear, at least I hope it does, telling us that when Q is greater than Q hat, as is likely the case in wealthy countries, popular insurgencies are not expected to occur, but more limited forms of violence are fairly likely. When Q is less than or equal to Q hat, as is likely true of poor countries, violence is likely to see popular participation, but is less likely to occur overall. Put simply, we should generally only see full-blown civil wars in poor countries. And many studies have observed that this is pretty much true, especially since World War II. But rich countries are hardly immune to political violence. It's just that the violence they see is more likely to look like the Irish Troubles than serious civil war. That's why I said that alleviating poverty might save lives and is a worthy goal in its own right, but it doesn't necessarily prevent violence in all its forms.